We sang the hymn, Hail Him. Brother Norby's topic is, Our King is Marching On.
Dear friends, I'm very happy to be with you today. The Patterson class voted to extend their Christian love and greetings to this convention, and we're happy to convey that message. We're also happy to convey the love and greetings of our wife, Mary, who you can sure is with us in spirit and in her prayers. I'm certainly happy to see so many of the brethren who have taken a definite stand for the truth. We know that we are to expect that there would be testings and siftings. I think the trouble is that we get a little tired, possibly. I think that stems largely from the fact we don't adjust our time to God's time. Now, if we are God's people, and particularly if we're have been called to be a part of the divine family, I think we should try to take God's standpoint and viewpoint more all the time. And that, I think, includes adjusting our time. And I think that one of the main reasons that brethren have faltered somewhat doctrinally, perhaps, and also character-wise, is the fact that the time has seemed so long. It's like my effort to explain to people why God permits evil, and I usually wind up with a thought, well, if God is going to intervene, why has he waited so long? Why hasn't he done something about it? Well, of course, we know it's taken time. It's taken time for enough people to be born into the world and get experience with evil. That's one reason. But mainly, actually, God has not waited long. That is according to his time. You remember he told Adam, in the day that thou eatest thereof, thou shalt surely die. And yet the Bible tells us that Adam lived 930 years. Well, now, there's only two alternatives. Either God's day, the day he referred to, is longer than 930 years, or else God didn't tell the truth, which is unthinkable, of course. So a day, in God's standpoint, is more than 930 years long. And even in the Old Testament, we read that 1,000 years are about yesterday with thee. One day. And of course, in the New Testament, Peter makes it more specific and emphatic when he said, would not ye should be ignorant of this, brethren, that a day with the Lord is as 1,000 years. And 1,000 years is one day. We're not supposed to be ignorant of that. Either theologically or in our actual, in our viewpoint of matters. So the millennial day, starting at 6 in the morning, ending at 6 at night, the Lord said, is not a day 12 hours. The night, it was really not counted as part of a working day, you know. And starting the millennium at 6 o'clock in the morning, do you know what time it is right now? Now, this is important. This will help us to put things in perspective. It is exactly now, 100 years has elapsed, a tenth part of 720 minutes, 72 minutes. It is now 12 minutes after 7 in the morning, according to God's reckoning. And we wonder, why he's so slow? Well, I doubt if you find many stores open at 12 minutes after 7 in the morning. And you certainly wouldn't find the governor sitting at his desk at that hour in the morning. But he intends to get his work done for that day. And so, let's not be impatient, brethren. I think that is the source of most of the discontent amongst the brethren, and a lot of questioning and lack of faith in what the Lord is doing. No, brethren, the Lord is not delaying. Our King is marching on, and he has been now for 100 years. Now we, of course, should be concerned about the main issues. There's one trouble that we get into after we've taken a stand on the main issues is that we are apt to blow up the minor issues use the same combativeness with the small issues as we would against more important ones. I don't think that would be the proper thing. The main issues, as I classify them, are the ones that would show up on the chart of the ages. And the things that we're talking about, the differences that we might have at this convention, I doubt if they show up at all on the chart of the ages. And now what we're really talking about, we have taken a stand, I think, against errors that would involve, say, 13 changes on that chart of the ages. Now, if we have escaped that, I think we should be very happy and thankful. We've just come through the memorial season, and we've learned considerable about the diligence of the Israelites and the performance of the ceremony. And they went to a great deal of trouble to make a type for us. In fact, I think we're so involved in the acting and in the drama, the performance of the drama, that they missed the plot, you see. They were merely actors in this great drama. But, I'm happy to know that the Lord pays his actors well, too. So, they will be the richer for the service that they have rendered, much of which has fallen to our benefit. We learned in our Passover celebration, memorial celebration, the necessity of putting away leaven. What is leaven? Well, we don't have to guess about this because the scriptures are very explicit. In Matthew, the 16th chapter, verses 6, 7, and 11 and 12, the Lord was warned his disciples to beware of the leaven of the Pharisees. Well, they thought, he's chiding us because we didn't bring bread. And that we'd have to perhaps go out and buy something. We didn't know what it was or something. But anyway, he read their minds, and then he gave them a little instruction, verses 8 through 10. And then verses 11 and 12 says, and then they understood that he was not speaking of the leaven and bread, but of the doctrine of the scribes and Pharisees. Erroneous doctrine, then, is leaven. Now, of course, we don't have the leaven of the Pharisees to contend with. But I think most housewives would know that the difference between a lot of leaven in some dough and a little leaven is just a matter of time. Maybe not too much time either, for that matter. A little leaven leaveneth the whole lump. So that's one form of leaven, which we are to be careful about, not say, well, it doesn't matter, it's not fundamental, it doesn't, I still believe in the ransom and so forth. But that careless attitude could clearly lead to something more serious, and it would. Now, of course, leaven is in the matter of doctrine. Leaven is specifically mentioned in connection with character in 1 Corinthians 5, verses 1 and 2. Remember the instance there where this man had taken his father's wife, and Paul was reprimanding them sharply. And he said that that they gloried in this. And ye are puffed up, and are not rather mourned. And in verse 6, your glorying is not good. Know ye not that a little leaven leaveneth the whole lump? Now here, of course, is another specific instance of leaven. It's involvement of character. In other words, leaven can be either along the lines of doctrine or character. But someone might say, well, we are supposed to cover up the differences with our brethren. After all, they're brethren, and we are supposed to cover that all with a mantle of love. Well, that, I think, is a fallacy, as demonstrated in this last text. Why do you suppose that the Corinthians were puffed up about this situation? Why were they glorying in it? Well, to my mind, it could only mean one thing. They had so much love, you see, that they could cover up even that. Again, I want to say we don't have that leaven to that degree. But I'm just showing the fallacy of using a mantle of love. Mistaken love, really. It isn't love. To cover up errors in doctrine or character. Even though they may not be this serious. Now again, we are to make a distinction in doctrines. The pastor wrote an article entitled Doctrines More or Less Important. And that, I think, has been misconstrued to read like this. Doctrines important and unimportant. Well, that isn't really what he says, is it? Doctrines more or less important. See, all doctrine is important. Some more and some less. Now, that's what he says, that's what he means, I believe, and I think that that's part of the harvest message, actually. But then to take a stand for the truth will bring the accusation of causing divisions. And here again, we usually have a misapplied text. We hear something like this, mark them that cause divisions. And usually the onus is on the wrong people, you know. The ones who have to take a stand for the truth are usually in the minority, and they seem to be troublemakers, and they seem to be precipitating a division, see. But the trouble is not reading the whole text. Mark them that cause divisions contrary to the doctrine that ye have learned. Now, in this group, I won't have to explain what doctrine we've learned. And the ones that are causing divisions are the ones who are teaching contrary to that doctrine. Even though they don't want a division, the ones who have to take a stand against that might actually precipitate the division. But they're not causing the division, scripturally speaking. I think that statement is very clear. And that, of course, is upheld by other scriptures, too. In 1 Corinthians 1:10, Paul exhorts them that ye all speak the same things, that there be no divisions among you. It's when we begin to teach other things contrary to the doctrine that we've learned that it would cause division, scripturally speaking. In 2 Timothy 3:14, Paul exhorts Timothy to continue in the things that he had learned and been assured of, knowing of whom he had learned. I think that goes for us down here, too. I think we know from whom we have learned. You ask God truth has been made plain to us down here. And our king is marching on, not only in the overturning of Satan's empire, but in promoting the truth of God's word and his plan. Now, we must all agree that the basis of fellowship is very broad. Now, this is shown, for instance, in the sixth volume, page 240. And this is what it is. Our number one, these are the questions we ask people, you know, before we extend the right hand of fellowship in their immersion. Our redemption through the precious blood and our justification by faith therein. Second, our consecration, sanctification, setting apart to the Lord the truth in their service, including the service of the brethren. Three, aside from these essentials upon which unity must be demanded, there can be no scriptural fellowship. Upon every other point, fullest liberty is to be accorded. With, however, a desire to see and to help others to see the divine plan in its every feature and detail. Now, that last clause necessitates the selection of teachers who are clear in the truth. If we have a desire to see and to help others to see the divine plan in its every feature and detail, then, of course, we must have teachers who are clear in the truth. Now, we're meeting in a school, and it reminds us that it's one thing to be in the second grade, it's something else to teach the second grade. That shows the difference, you see. We can be brethren with a very limited knowledge of the truth, but we shouldn't teach, not even the second grade, if we are not clear in the subjects that are being discussed. And I wonder if they have any teachers on the faculty here who don't agree with the textbooks that this particular district recommends. I think that's one of the qualifications of the teacher. And I think if that's true, in a natural sense, that's even more important to the spiritual sons of God who should be in harmony with the textbooks. You know, the Lord is looking for those who will go out, perhaps, in expanding universe and spread the Lord's glory and goodness abroad, the remote reaches of the universe. And, of course, he'll select only the ones who will go by the book, you know, by his instructions. Well, we might say, well, if the Lord gave me a set of rules to go by, if he gave me a book, I would live up to that book. Well, all right, we can prove it right now. He's given us a book. Revelator calls it a little book. Not very big at this stage, but it's plenty exacting anyway. And the Lord can judge us by how we handle the little knowledge that we have now, how faithful we are to the instructions that he's given us, as to judge us to our qualifications to handle more important matters. Thou hast been faithful in a few things, I'll make thee ruler over many things. Now, the qualifications, then, of teachers is something different. In 1 Timothy 4:16, take heed unto thyself and unto the doctrine, continue in them. Now, some would say, well, that doctrine, that's the ransom, singular. And notice he says, continue in them. Doctrine, you see, refer to all the doctrine. Charge them that they teach no other doctrine. 1 Timothy 1:3-4. 1 Timothy 5:22, lay hands suddenly on no man. It implies a careful selection of teachers or elders. Titus 1:7-14. read all of that, but it's all very good. So let us therefore, holding forth the faithful word as you've been taught, that he may be able by sound doctrine both to exhort and to convince the gainsayers. Wherefore, rebuke them sharply that they may be sound in the faith. In Philippians 3, 15, 16, let us therefore, as many as be perfect, be thus minded. And if in anything ye be otherwise minded, well, someone might say, well, don't worry about it, unless it's a doctrine of the ransom or resurrection or the call of the church or something, don't worry about it, if we be otherwise minded. But again, we stop short of what the apostle is talking about here. And if in anything ye be otherwise minded, God shall reveal even this unto you. We should expect to progress in knowledge. There's no excuse for losing our appreciation of the truth, our understanding of the truth. If we're unable to comprehend it in the first place, God makes allowance for that. But if we have attained it in the first place, there's no excuse for losing it if we are in the Lord's favor. You see? If we would be dependable as instructors, for instance. And he continues. He'll reveal even this unto you. Nevertheless, whereto ye have already attained, let us walk by the same rule, let us mind the same thing. Let's not slip backward in our understanding and appreciation of the truth. He gave pastors and teachers, now he's talking about leaders, isn't he? Not brethren, we're all brethren. He's talking about the qualifications for leaders. He gave pastors and teachers till we all come in the unity of the faith and of the knowledge unto a perfect man, that we henceforth be no more children tossed to and fro and carried about with every wind of doctrine. Ephesians 4, 11 to 14. That's the function, you see, of the leaders, is to lead to a clear understanding of the truth and to be established so that every wind of doctrine would not blow us away. Now, the Lord made a very significant statement, and this is important. The matter of love for the brethren. Jesus said, whosoever shall break one of these least commandments and teach men so shall be least in the kingdom of heaven. Now, actually, it's the teaching of error that is such a serious matter. Because it stumbles one of the Lord's little ones. It'd be bad enough to have the error, but to teach it would mean a demotion in the kingdom. You know, I feel that I'm going to have to live with the brethren throughout all eternity. I look forward to that. And I'm more concerned about what they think of me throughout the everlasting future than I am what they think of me right now. They might think now, well, Brother Norby, in the kingdom, if I happen to be right on some subject, say, Brother Norby, I thought you were too straight-laced on doctrine. I thought you were too severe. You didn't have enough love. Now, you didn't agree with me. You thought I had error on a certain point, and yet you patted me on the back and wished me Godspeed. And, you know, as a result of teaching that error, I actually am demoted in the kingdom on this rule, you see. Now, that's one way of looking at it, you see. But on the other hand, if we refuse to support brethren who are teaching error, you see, who are not clear in the truth, not qualified as teachers, brethren, of course, we all love them. We love them so much we wouldn't injure them by tarnishing their crown in the kingdom. And this is how they can tarnish their crown, by being promoted, supported, in responsible positions, teaching error, which would actually demote them in the kingdom. So I'd rather have them feel, well, if I'm right now, this may be all, maybe the other way around. And if they're right and I'm wrong, I would still appreciate them trying to help me and to hinder me from blundering into something that would tarnish my crown, you see. So I'd rather have them say, Brother Norby, I thought you were pretty straight-laced in the matters of the truth and following the harvest message and so on. And you didn't support me, and I thought ill of you at the time. I thought you were too narrow, unloving, and so on. But I wish I'd heeded your advice. I don't have quite as honored a position in the kingdom because I was teaching certain errors, and in spite of what some of the brethren were trying to do to dissuade me from the subject. Now, we have to take our choice. We'll be living with our brethren throughout all eternity. How are they going to look back upon us? Have we been helping to tarnish their crown, or have we been trying to polish it up and to enhance their position in the kingdom? And, of course, we have the pastor. The pastor was right on the beam on this subject. He's right in harmony with the Bible. I suggest you look these references up. The sixth volume, page 274. Page 275, the top of the page. Page 285. Page 323. 327. And 316. These are all very good. I have excerpts here. But he says, always remembering that humility and clearness in the truth are the prime essentials for our leaders. Now, I think the one of the difficulties that we have about recognizing that the king, our king, is marching on. He's been with us for 100 years. He has been operating according to his plan. A passage, Ezekiel 21:27. When the Lord told Zedekiah, remove the diadem, take off the crown, it shall be no more until he come whose right it is, and I will give it to him. Now, I know that the would-be successor to the pastor changed the date of the Lord's return. And I think it is partly on the basis of this scripture that the least of the Gentiles will run until 1914, and that Christ would not return until the least of the Gentiles had expired. Because that's what is being what's mentioned there in Ezekiel 21:27, that the dominion of Israel would be overturned. I will overturn it until he come whose right it is, and I will give it to him. Now that is partly a basis for assuming that the Lord didn't return until 1914. See? Of course, that's characteristic, you know, of the unfaithful servant. The Lord delayeth his coming, so on. And that has been a test on some of the brethren. And I know that some actually hold that view. But whether they actually believe that now or not, that there is a tendency to fall into that. Because if we throw out some of the main evidence of the Lord's return in 1874, what are we coming up with? What's it going to lead to? If we throw out the Jubilees, if we throw out the chronology, throw out these various types that strongly indicate the Lord's return, 1874, it's bound to weaken our faith in that great fact, isn't it? If in some cases it may not already be true. Now, I think that this message of the Lord's, of this centennial of our Lord's presence is a message mainly for the Bible students. It's something we should be sure that all the Bible students really believe, and that we should strengthen our faith in that great fact, I think. Now, as respects 1874, we have the times of restitution, the jubilees, the chronology, all of which emphasize 1874. But there are other outward physical manifestations, too. And that was the great increase of knowledge, the increase of inventions, labor-saving devices, beginning exactly at 1874. Up to 1874, including that very, those very few years in 1870s, the average rate was 10 per decade. Great inventions listed in the World Almanac. And there was only 3 in the 4 years in the 1870s. But starting in 1874, the rate jumped 3 times. There were 31 in the last 5 years of the 1870s. Now, I'm talking about great inventions, ones that are noted by the World Almanac. The experimental automobile in 1875, was that important? The telephone in 1876, was that important? The microphone in 1877. The electric light. 1878. We wouldn't do so well without that, would we? And then in the 1880s, it jumped up to 41 for the decade, 47. Actually, the great inventions have tapered off. The basic inventions, you see, there have been improvements on all these things. But think of these basic inventions that came out immediately. The labor-saving devices, the wonders of this new age, the potential millennial blessings. Man hasn't used them wisely. That's not the Lord's fault, you see. 1878 is very well marked. And it's closely related and dependent upon 1874. In 1878, we believe the sleeping saints were raised. That was a setting up of the major part of the new heavens, right there. And one great act, the resurrection of those sleeping saints. There was also the beginning of the nation of Israel. You know, I think we may, in Kissinger, we may have a parallel to Disraeli. I'm not emphatic on this. I'm not sure how this is going to work out. But some remarkable things are happening. Disraeli, for instance, purchased the Suez Canal in 1875. He was the first and only Jewish prime minister of Great Britain, the most powerful nation of the world at the time. Kissinger probably reopened the Suez Canal in 1975. It's largely through his negotiations that they've come to any peaceful settlement over there at all. Some think he's giving too much away, but it's a give-and-take proposition. Nobody's going to be completely vanquished or complete victorious in wars nowadays. And he seems to be realistic about this matter. And I wouldn't be surprised what we're going to have peace over there for a few years. There's a prelude. We've got to have that, you know. They got to dwell in peace and safety when the final attack comes. And then no human power is going to save them. The United States will not be able to maintain its commitments. That is being weakened now, of course. That's the worst place in the world to fight communism, anyway. And so the Lord will intervene. He'll gather all, in Zechariah 14, he'll gather all nations against Jerusalem. The city shall be taken, the houses rifled, and the women ravished, and half of the city shall go forth into captivity. Well, that'll convince the whole world and convince the Jews that it's hopeless from their point of view. Then what? Then will I fight for them as I fought in the day of battle. That's what's needed in this situation. A demonstration that God is on the side of Israel. It'll be manifest in their deliverance. And believe me, that's going to convert the unbelieving Jews, too. I don't blame them too much for not believing what they've gone through. But when they see this, this will make them believe pretty well. And it'll awaken the whole world to the fact that the Lord has intervened. I believe that as sure as I'm standing here, because it's in the book. And the Lord will intervene. He'll have to, and he will. So we can be confident that that is not going to be lost over there. Well, what is more important that Israeli did was at the Berlin Congress, we're all familiar with this, the pastor covers it in the volumes, that he presided over the Berlin Congress. He was, at least he was prime minister of the most powerful nation of the world. And Britain took the side of Turkey. Turkey didn't want the Russians to get into the Mediterranean. And Britain didn't either, of course. And so Britain supported Turkey. And in return for that, one of the things, Disraeli forced the Turks to allow the Jews to own real estate in Palestine. Well, they hadn't been able to own real estate in Palestine for hundreds of years. The Jews recognized that is the grassroots of their new nation. I have in my pocket two stamps commemorating the 70th anniversary of the establishment of the first two colonies in Israel. It shows the Jews now point back to 1878 as important in the establishment of the earthly kingdom. And that, you see, is a counterpart to the establishment of the new heavens. The resurrection of the sleeping saints. Has the Lord been doing anything? When he's raised the sleeping saints, when he's been adding to them through the harvest work, he's been adding to them year by year. And here, if we don't have the eye of faith, all we have to do is read the papers. There is Israel established. We have the assurance that they're going to make a go of it, because this is the time for that final regathering, according to the prophecy. Now, 1881 hinges on this same base of the Lord's return, 1874. Now, the first volume, in its original form, Food for Thinking Christians, same general material, but in a different form, which came out in the first volume, 1886. 1881, Food for Thinking Christians, The Divine Plan. In the same year, the Tabernacle Shadows came out. Here we have the Divine Plan in, corroborated by the types. Is that just a coincidence? That at the time that the general call ended, and we talk about a general call ending, and we think, well, only a few would be allowed to come in. Now, I have a different understanding of that. That was a call by all the different agencies of the churches. The Lord cast Babylon off. And then he brought out his own message, you see. And it's very much like a restaurant, you know, that serves meals all day long. You can go in and sit down any place. But when you get toward the dinner hour, they'll put up a sign, wait for the hostess. And then nobody goes in until somebody comes out. Now, that's the situation. All the places had been filled for the first time in 1881. But did that mean that the work was over? Well, it wouldn't be with a restaurant. For the first time, they'd be working at full capacity, really, with the space that was still available. And how else can you reconcile the idea of a harvest work going on after the general call ended? See the point. The tremendous turnover, you see, when people come in, how many make their calling election sure? When they lose their crown, it's apportioned to somebody else. So anyway, 1881 was very significant. And you know that the grand gallery in the pyramid is exactly 1,881 inches long. Pastor touches on this in the chapter on the Great Pyramid. I'm just mentioning a few things to establish the reliability of these dates, all hinging upon the Lord's return. Now, I'd like to refer you to experiences of Elijah and Elisha. I think as Bible students we recognize the importance of this as a type. And we'll skip over to the final experiences of Elijah and Elisha. Second Kings, the second chapter, verses 11 and 12. And it came to pass as they still went on after crossing Jordan and talked, that behold, there appeared a chariot of fire and horses of fire and parted them both asunder. And Elijah went up by a whirlwind into heaven. He didn't go up in a chariot. That's a misconception, you know. The artists take and the writers take poetic license on that. They have Elijah going up in a chariot, but the Bible doesn't say that, actually. And I don't believe that it was true. Now, it happened that I've been out west where they didn't have, in a time where they didn't have paved roads, even gravel roads, not even graded roads. And what did we have? We just had a trail down across the country, and there were always two tracks, you see. You all have to have two wheels on a chariot. And those wheels were spaced on a wagon or whatever it is. And those wheels were spaced for about the distance that the animals that would pull them would be the distance that they would be apart, two horses or two oxen or whatever it was. And so I can visualize this. You pardon me if I kind of ramble a little on this. But I can visualize what happened. Here was a trail, and Elijah was on one side, walking in one track, and Elisha on the other. What else? And suddenly they heard a roar, and they looked up, and here was a chariot bearing down on them. These horses running at top speed. Now, what would they instinctively do? Why, they would each go to their side of the road, wouldn't they? You can't imagine they'd both go to one side. They didn't have much time, you see. They would jump to the side of the road that they happened to be on. And the chariot whizzed between them. And then a tornado came along. Now, you know the characteristics of a tornado? You've been experiencing a little of that out here. You know, a tornado will wipe out all the houses on one side of the street and hardly touch the other side. I can almost imagine. The Lord uses natural means, possibly. This tornado could well have taken Elijah and left Elisha on the other side of the road. Particularly if they ran rather rapidly off in opposite directions. Well, anyway, that's apparently what happened. Now, what was this chariot? Well, they represent fiery experiences, fiery chariot and so on. But you know, there's something specific about this chariot. It's described for us. What is this chariot? And Elijah saw it and cried, "My father, my father, the chariot of Israel and the horsemen thereof." Allow me to make this observation that the errors on the subject of Israel are not the only errors by any means. I mentioned 13 changes on the chart, many serious errors that have been introduced. But the subject of Israel is very important, and it happens to be the spearhead of these errors. You know, it's a shame to the Bible students who have such a rich heritage on this subject of Israel that there's a lot of anti-Semitism amongst the Lord's people. They're ready to believe that Israel will be disinherited in a special place in the kingdom. That is the first error that is introduced publicly or in publications. About the only one that's come out very openly. And the friends have all gone along with this wrong idea. Well, I wouldn't be dogmatic on this. I think this chariot may mean something more than the subject of Israel, but may I suggest one thing, that we be on the right side on this Israel issue? Now the thought is that the new covenant will not be made with the nation of Israel. In the first place, it wouldn't be a new covenant, as the pastor points out, except with one that had an old covenant. But more specifically, read in the book of Hosea. Let me give you these references. The Lord indicates that he's going to remarry his unfaithful wife. Now, what nation did he have a covenant with? What nation was called his wife? He says he was an husband unto them, Israel, of course. And you know, he indicates so dramatically how he is going to remarry that unfaithful wife. Read Hosea, the first chapter and the second verse. The second chapter, verses 13, 14, 19, and 20. And then the same thing is taught in the book of Ezekiel in the 16th chapter. The second verse shows that it's directed especially to Jerusalem. And then follows 58 verses of some of the most indelicate language that you'll find in the Bible, in which God is denouncing his unfaithful wife, Israel. And yet, when he comes over to verses 60 and 62, yet will I remember you, I covenant with you in the days of your youth, and I will bring you into the covenant. And he said, I'll give you Samaria and a couple of other nations he mentions as daughters. Well, then Israel will be something of a mother, won't she? A secondary sense, of course. Spiritual Israel is the real mother. But the Lord says that fleshly Israel, this unfaithful wife, when she has been remarried, incidentally, she will have been converted by that time, too, and reformed. But he's going to make a covenant. Now, how could the Lord make that lesson any clearer than that? I'm flabbergasted that the brethren don't get that point. After the Lord put these faithful prophets through that experience, particularly Hosea, told him to go out and marry a disreputable woman, because that's what he was going to do. God never asked anybody, any of his servants, to do anything he wasn't doing, willing to do himself, or wasn't doing. When he asked Abraham to sacrifice his son, he had already sacrificed his son from before the foundation of the world. You know, I want to let that lesson pass. The Lord made it graphic enough for me. I think the lesson is pretty clear. I'm going to be on the right side on the matter of who the new covenant is going to be made with. Oh, of course, they'll be under the ancient worthies. There's nobody's question. That's not an issue. There's nobody, no Bible student I know of, that believes that the ancient worthies are not going to be the rulers over the nation of Israel and the world at that time. But they are not the nation. They are not the nation that the Lord is going to make the covenant with. That's the point. Well, you know, we talk about the times of the Gentiles. Before the times of the Gentiles, what did we have? We had the times of Israel, didn't we? You only have I known of all the nations of the earth, the Lord said. And then he turned the kingdom over to, he leased it to the Gentiles. He never deeded it to the Gentiles, actually. Israel is God's heir, you know. But they weren't worthy, and so God leased it to outsiders, to strangers for a while. So when the times of the Gentiles are over, what do you have? You're either a Jew or a Gentile in Bible usage. So after the times of the Gentiles, well, then, of course, it would revert to the times of Israel again. And there we have it, the Gentiles going out of the picture and Israel coming in. This is a little realism, you know. You know, it's an interesting thing. They now have a magazine called The Times of Israel. I got a great thrill out of that. They've only been two or three issues come out. It's very good. But the title, The Times of Israel, that's a great truth, actually. We're living in the times of Israel. And we'd have any evidence of it if we just open our eyes. Now, I've already pointed out how that our differences are relatively small. And you should, I know when I was out west and we did some hunting, we used a different caliber gun when we were out for big game than when we were out for jackrabbits, something like that. And I think we should follow that same procedure, you know, when it's a matter of errors. When we're really faced up with some really important, serious errors and powerful brethren that are supporting them and promoting them, we would have to use a little more combativeness than we would when we get down to some of the finer points. As I say, the things that we're talking about here, the differences we might have, don't show up on that chart of the ages. Well, we've got to make a difference. In my opinion, we're making a great mistake if we don't. We use a heavy artillery on these relatively less important points. Not that they're unimportant, as I've already stressed. Now, the issue perhaps with us is with respect to Babylon. Will Babylon cause us any trouble, or are they on the way out so completely they won't have any influence in stopping the truth and so on? That's one of the issues that disturbing the brethren. Well, actually, the pastor makes it pretty clear that there's some truth in both thoughts. That Babylon will be in great distress at the time that she would lash out against the truth and the truth people. And I'm very familiar with one short paragraph in the third volume, page 231, and the middle of the page, paragraph 2, I think it is. The pastor said it will probably be in an effort at self-preservation. I'm going to mark 7 expressions that indicate that Babylon will be in distress at the time that they would lash out. On the way down, you might say. Like a wounded animal, they become more dangerous. They probably be an act of self-preservation, number one. On the part of Great Babylon, when she sees her power in politics and priestcraft waning, number two, that the work of truth spreading will be stopped as detrimental to her system. Now, how does she know it's detrimental? She's felt the effect of it. Three, see? Probably at this juncture, the Elijah class persisting in declaring the truth, not necessarily taking up something special or different, persisting in the same message, might suffer violence, pass into glory, just in the crisis, number four, of affairs, life or death, when men feel that desperate, number five, measures must be resorted to sustain, defensive again, the tottering, number seven, structure of Babylon. That's when they could become dangerous. Now, we don't serve our cause. I happen to believe that we will witness this very thing. But I don't think we're serving our cause much by insisting that the churches will become so powerful, you see, individually anyway, and particularly that the papacy will become so powerful. That's contrary to the thought in the Scriptures. You remember the pastor said Herod, Herodias, and Salome. It was Salome that had the power. in the final picture. It's the image of the beast that's going to have the power in the final picture. So we should avoid the extremes on this, which will only aggravate these small differences that we have. It reminds me of an actual, this is a true story, some of you have heard this before, about a cousin who was following a panel truck on an icy road. And suddenly this truck veered off, slid off the road, and rolled over and over in the ditch. My cousin rushed up with his heart in his throat, and he thought, certainly this man must be killed. Well, as he approached the truck, the man crawled out, and he stood there holding side, you know, and, oh, my, oh, my. And my cousin said, quick, get in the car. Let's take you to the hospital. Well, the fellow said, well, he said, no. He said, I'm not hurt. But he said, look at my truck. Well, you know, at that stage, the fear that my cousin had really turned to anger, you know, the thought. Well, here, he said, you know, you could have been killed or seriously injured. I saw what happened. I said, it's a miracle you didn't, that you came out of this alive. The fellow said, I said, I've already considered that. But he said, now look at my truck. Now, if we've escaped the pestilence of some serious errors, we should be so thankful about that that we wouldn't just build up a case of our other problems. See the point? And I think that is true. Now, I think an important point is that how we view some of the corrections that were made in the volumes overemphasize the slight modifications that the pastor had. It's mostly based on premature expectations. And you know, if that disqualified the pastor, why then we would disqualify even the inspired apostles. They thought the Lord was going to return quite soon. Certainly they didn't realize it would be 1900 years. But that didn't alter the fact that they were inspired along other lines. Now, we don't claim an inspiration for the seventh messenger. But how could we allow that, the fact that he didn't understand the time, to invalidate the authority of his teachings along other lines? And then, of course, as we come across these different places where it happens to mention 1914, why, maybe that annoys us, you know. Well, actually, it's not all these, they're not all different mistakes. They're just one mistake, that's all. And he explains that it was the beginning of the trouble instead of the culmination, and so forth. There again, I think it's so important in our research on this and that we don't overemphasize these little specks, so to speak. You know, it's like ivory soap. They don't claim it as perfect. And I'm sure that if you took a magnifying glass, particularly in the presence of the children, you know, and I go through there and say, oh, look at this is a speck of dust. Here's a little piece of hair over here, like that. Now, if you did too much of that, the children would get the idea they'd get dirty by using it. Now, that's what we've got to avoid, you see, in our evaluation of the pastor's writings. Don't allow our research on some of these things. Actually, most of these seeming contradictions are not so. I don't think that these things are too important. We should, for instance, in the matter of the Lord's second presence, I just mentioned this, that there might seem to be a contradiction. The pastor in reprints 5040. In column 1, he recommends that you don't start out with people on the second presence or in the Trinity or immortality of the soul. Now, I don't think that he should set up a contradiction. I don't think that Paul contradicted that thought. Paul never said that Christ was present, you know. He talked about Christ's second coming, sure. But to start out with. Any more than when we talk to the Jews, we don't start out converting them to Christ, not if we're giving the right witness to the Jews. They get that in our general witness. The nominal church people get the second presence in our general witness. But when you're talking to a fundamentalist, you tell them, well, they say, what's the difference between preaching that Christ will return and that he's present? Well, you tell these friends, you know, I think Christ's going to return soon. God bless you, brother. He may return to, I think he's going to return tomorrow. Hallelujah. You tell them that he returned yesterday, and they'll look at you kind of funny. They didn't see him, you know. You tell them that he returned 100 years ago, and they'll maybe get on the telephone to see if somebody's escaped. Well, that's a little exaggeration, but we are to use tact in presenting these things. I think that in certain cases, we are to follow the pastor's advice, reprint 5040. And not use that as a general to all people. If you've had any experience on this particular thing, you'll find that the pastor was right. But that doesn't mean we can't rejoice in the Lord's centennial of his presence. It doesn't mean that we should expect the brethren to believe that. And it doesn't mean that we shouldn't rejoice in this wonderful theme. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't proclaim it in a general witness, but to use it in every specific instance, you would be setting up a contradiction in the pastor's teachings and in his practice, I believe. Now I'd say there's many difficulties in the world. I don't think we're going to have to go out and look for trouble. We don't have to join the Lord's great army. But we are supposed to proclaim the message. It's the way we received it. And I don't think we're going to have to go out looking for them, looking for trouble. I think they'll be looking for us. A brother told me that he had received 2 letters recently. One of them had been marked open for postal inspection. And another one had been opened without any notation to that effect. We just don't know what's going on. And I don't think we're going to have to go out looking for trouble. But at the same time, I don't think we should compromise the message that we've been giving all this while. Our King is indeed marching on.
Lord bless you, Brother Norby. We thank God that we have a clear understanding of the present truth, for it is the present truth that shows us that our King is marching on.